Once more under the breach, dear friends.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Whoa. I'm always impressed when we do that. We get it right. We get our names out. And I'm always a little confused as to what to do next. I guess I should probably
You could get a gold star for that. We said our names in public.
We did.
Together.
On the radio.
Woohoo! Yeah. Everybody needs to celebrate that.
Took us
every week.
20-some years of practicing to get it right.
I'm not sure I'm confident to say that we'll get it right every time.
No, we won't. We'll forget something somewhere. Anyway, the Personal Wealth Coach, this is where the disclosures start to come in. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the radio program you're listening to, it is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm who has as its regulator the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. And the regulated investment advisory firm is based in Salado, Texas. And it's not a coincidence. They have the same name as the name one and the other name two, and that the two guys here are also there.
Right. And just because the firm is
I didn't say SEC registered.
Just because the firm, yes you did.
I said it's an investment advisory firm regulated by the SEC.
Right. And just because they're regulated and registered with the SEC doesn't mean that the SEC somehow endorses them. I don't think they endorse anybody.
They unendorse
even their own endorsements.
Yes, and I need to tell you that this radio program is not paid for by us. We do advertise for the radio program on the radio station. That's something else that I'm required to disclose, so it's been disclosed. The information we present on here is educational, not advisory information. I know that sounds kind of silly, but that's the way it is.
Yeah.
And let's see, what else? The information we present on here has been retained from stuff that we think is reliable and sources we think is reliable, but
are
no guarantees.
Reliable. Sources is reliable. Sources am reliable.
I'm doing that, okay? And then we also, the other disclosure I need to make is that we have a telephone number here, and it's called 254-773-1400, and there's somebody on that line who is waiting to get on the air. So whoever you are, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was just going to mention one thing to you. When y'all announce your names and everything,
yes.
Jeff and Jake, well, that sounds just perfect, but that McClure part, one of you is kind of off a little bit, so maybe y'all might need to practice on that part.
Oh,
but
man, that, we got to work on that.
Great, man.
Man, we've
Thank
been...
you, sir. I'm just messing with you. Y'all have yourself a wonderful day, sir. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, we've been practicing for 20-some years now. I don't know.
We got work to do, evidently.
But
we got to figure out how do we say our last name.
Together. In harmonious.
No, I don't know if that may be stretching it. Just saying it together maybe is.
I said inharmoniously.
Oh, yeah. Inharmoniously. That makes sense. Just not harmoniously.
We could try.
We're usually very trying.
Very, that's what a lot of
very
people
trying.
Say.
I mean, we talk about economics all the time. People invite us to, hey, come on over here and have a barbecue. All right, stop talking about the macroeconomics of the chicken.
Oh, that's crucial, the macroeconomics
of
the chicken.
Have you followed the supply chain?
Do you know there's
I just want to eat the chicken.
Do you know that there's actually an excess of eggs in the system right now?
Yes, I do.
And as a result, egg prices are falling and milk prices are falling.
Avocado prices are falling.
After rising earlier this year.
Yeah, the avocado prices are falling right now, and it's for a very, very sophisticated reason.
Really? What is it?
It's harvest time. It's very sophisticated, I tell you. Very sophisticated.
Well, that makes sense. Well, I guess we should talk about the market. We're already talking about the market, aren't we?
We are. Yeah, just avocado and veggie and fruit market. It's the same stuff. The chicken market, the livestock market, the flea market, and the stock market, they're really not that different.
Well, I've been looking for a flea market for a long time, but I've watched fleas, and I've never seen them standing around pillars and exchanging flea eggs or whatever.
That's
it is that
because they do it only at the flea market, and you have to be there in order to watch it happen.
Well, I've actually been to flea markets looking for fleas, and everybody thinks, where are the fleas?
And
they won't tell me.
They all went to the circus.
That makes sense. I haven't been to a flea circus.
Yeah, you got a flea circus.
I don't think I've ever actually seen a flea circus.
Well, that's the point. Do you know where that name comes from?
No.
Okay. Growing up, I saw it in a lot of cartoons, and I didn't understand how could you ever have a flea circus? You know, they got the little Ferris wheel in the cartoons. This is Warner Brothers cartoons, Bugs Bunny and stuff. And the fleas are all doing these things. It's from a street side kind of funny routine where a guy claims that there's a flea circus, only you can't see anything. So he's making the Ferris wheel turn, or he's making a little tink sound in a cup as the flea jumps off of a diving board. But there's no flea. There's just a little.
So it's a scam.
Yeah. Well, sort of. This is as much a scam as any other entertainment.
Entertaining scam.
It's an entertainment thing.
Speaking of entertainment things, the stock market this week did a lot of stuff. I could stop right there.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, if you followed it day to day on October 1st and 2nd, it went into a nosedive, and there was great angst and fear. It went down, was going down over 1% a day, and it continued down another day over 1% a day, and then it seesawed around, and then there was this, and then there was that, and by the end of the week, it had lost, the S&P 500 had lost 0.33%.
Yes. So a lot of noise, a lot of movement, but on average, almost nothing.
Right. And it's one of the reasons that it's really good to read our newsletter is because if you just look at the stock market, or you never look at it more than once a week. Once a week is probably a little too frequently.
Yeah, you should look at it every few years.
You know, like
really,
there
to
was
just get all the noise out of the way.
For those of you who can't remember back this far, because this is really a long time ago, in December of last year, the stock market went into a nosedive, and intraday was actually down 20% for just a little bit.
I'm surprised at this. People don't remember that.
That's just astonishing to me.
It was just
too.
December.
So if you'd watched it during December, you'd have been really scared and upset, and people were, and they called and said, oh, the world is coming to an end, or words to that effect. But it was interesting because if you look at where the stock market is today, or was Friday, I should say, was yesterday, and where it was a year ago, it's up a whopping 2.3%. In other words, it really hasn't done much of anything for the last year.
Ah, but wait till December. In December, the year-over-year things, assuming we don't have a crash in December, it's going to look amazing.
Oh, that's right.
All the numbers are going to suddenly look like we had this stellar performance for the year, when the reality is we had a big dip in last December.
So come the end of the year, if the stock market just hums along doing nothing, like it's been doing very enthusiastically, we'll see a 20% gain in the stock market at the end of the year.
And everyone will go, whoa, so somebody did something amazing. And the reality is that's just how numbers work.
We did nothing and it looked amazing.
Yeah, we had a crash and then a recovery. But that's when you measure from the bottom of the crash, it sure looks like you did really well.
The real question that people should be asking, in my humble opinion, well, maybe not too
What
humble.
Is it? Is that the question? Did I
no,
just ask
no,
the... Oh,
no.
Man, I asked the wrong question about the question?
Right.
Okay, go ahead. I'm not going to try anymore.
The real question that people should be asking is, why is the stock market up 2.3% over the last year?
That is a good question.
Because...
What have earnings done over the last year?
Declined.
Hmm.
Not much. They've declined a little bit. But more interestingly...
What has the business environment changed to look better or worse?
Worse.
Why is the market up?
And that's one of the things we can talk about today, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, there was an article in the Financial Times says that traders are playing chicken with the economy.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of truth in that. So the bond market, on the other hand... had a more, in my opinion, our opinion. I don't know if it's, is it your opinion too? If I have an opinion,
market,
do you have an opinion? Yeah, is a little
my
more,
opinion
a little
about
more the, pessimistic view of the world.
But my opinion about the opinion might be different than your opinion
Could be.
About it.
The stock market is basically saying all this bad economic news, which we're going to talk about, was really not all that bad, and it was okay, and we'll just drop 0.33%. That was the consensus on Wall Street. Now, once you get into the very widely dispersed bond market, most of which is still in New York, by the way, the Treasury bond market, The U.S. Treasury note yield continued its decline. It closed out at 1.528. Now, let's put this in the 10-year Treasury note, 1.528%. What does that mean? Well, let's put it this way. It was well above 3% a year ago, which means the Treasury note yield, which is how the Treasury note, how we forecast what all the masses of people who are trading and buying and selling Treasury notes basically collectively have concluded that interest rates 10 years from now will be half of what they were thinking a year ago. A year ago, they were thinking 3%. That'll accommodate inflation and give me a little bit of gain. Now they're saying 1.5% will accommodate inflation and give me a little bit of gain. Whoa, that is an interesting thing. But the 90-day T-bill is 1.7, and the 10-year note is 1.5. That means we have an inverted yield curve, which means the collective wisdom, without even trying to collude with one another, in the bond market is that there's a recession coming, and at this point, if we look at the historical nature of the way this prediction runs, it'll be sometime next year. Now, that's impressive, but the five-year note is even more impressive.
Yeah.
It's sitting down there at 1.3, and it was over 3% in 2018 at this time.
Now, somebody that just turned on this channel and is listening to us, or clicked on the web and is listening to us, is hearing us talk about these less than half a percent differentials, mm-hmm. between them. What's so important about this? Why is it people say that the bond market is predicting disaster? What is this about?
Basically, the bond market is saying collectively that interest rates 3 to 10 years from now will be much lower. Two years from now will be much lower than they are today. And lower interest rates mean the economy has slowed down a whole bunch.
Yeah. So,
which kinda, is one of those technical terms.
And when they're saying it, let's kind of lay this out. People say the bond market is predicting. We tend to make the bond market a unified voice. Like we say, the stock market says, or what is the stock market telling you, sir? The reality is it's a bunch of people.
Bunch.
That is the technical term.
Right.
A lot of people.
A whole bunch.
All operating in what they think is a good move individually.
Right.
And what they're doing in the bond market is they're looking at the trade war. They're looking at stocks. They're looking around and they say, you know, stocks are up over what they were. But the trade war is kind of a headwind in this. We're walking into the breeze, and the breeze has gone from a light breeze to gale force now. It's slowing business enough that maybe it's not even moving forward. What do I do with my money? So they have this money, and it's either in their bank or in cash positions, or sometimes in the stock market, sometimes in other bonds. The bonds mature. What do they do with this money? They've got to make a decision. They can choose to buy into the stock market. They can choose to buy to stay in a bank account in a cash position. What were you going to say?
Well, there's basically a decision that goes one of two ways. Do I want to invest my money with the possibility of making more money in the future, or am I more concerned about the fact that if I invest my money for the long term, I'll lose it and I'll see a decline in it?
And then we have a joke that runs return of principal rather than return on principal.
And as yields go down in the bond market, that means the volume of purchases has gone up. That
right.
means that more people are concerned about getting their money back than they are about making money.
Right. So this is normal, very normal, at a mature point in a bull market. If you just think this is not a perfect scenario, because we really recommend not treating the stock market like Vegas. But if you've gone to Vegas and you say, I'm only going to gamble for one day, and you close to the end of the day, you look at the amount of money that you have, and you have a lot more than you started with, a lot of people would say, all right, I'm just going to end the day with this. And that's what we're seeing the stock market do. And we see that behaviorally at the end of these big bull markets for long periods of time. People say, I've gotten a lot of gains out of this. I have liquidated. Now I don't want to stick it back in the market. So what do I do with it? Well, where's the safest place you can put it? Well, the safest place you can put it is with the U.S. government. And that's, you know, some people laugh when I say that. What is the safest place to put it? The U.S. government, and they laugh.
That's true, though.
It's true. Compared to anywhere else out there, it is the safest place to be with long-term money because constitutionally, the debts of the United States are protected. It's at the same level as the powers of the president or the powers of Congress. We must pay our debts. That's in the Constitution. Unless we care to change that, the courts can shut down the government if we spend the money on other things than debt. So it may not be great that we're getting more debt, but it's still safe. It has that number one priority on expenditures in the government level. So that's an important factor. So they're taking this money from short-term positions, the bank, little money market positions, and they're turning and dropping it into the long-term positions. Well, if you have a lot of people buying the long-term positions, those long-term positions don't have to pay as much to get you to buy it. They can lower their interest rate. That's how the auction market works. So interest rates on the long-term are dropping, and that's just a sign that there's less business investing going on right now. When long-term rates are dropping, at the same time, short-term rates have actually come up. Even though the Federal Reserve is dropping rates on the short-term level, we still have spikes and peaks of much higher short-term interest rates. And it's because the money is leaving those short-term positions and the banks are saying, we don't have enough short-term cash, so we have to raise our interest rates. That's a yield curve inversion. It's people say the bond market is predicting. It's really an effect of people saying, I'm not sure I want to risk this in the market. I would much rather put it in a really safe position. That's the prediction. It's not, and it's not all these people on average saying, I don't think the market's going to do well. It's them simply saying, I don't want it not to do well.
And there's a really interesting debate going on among economists right now to do with that yield curve. And we've talked about this before, but it's important to understand. Banks make money by paying you on the short term and loaning on the long term.
And if they do that right now, they'll lose money.
Yeah, and they're in a really awkward position where if they were lending exactly at the treasury rate, which they don't, then they would be paying around 2% on short-term money, and you can get online banking services where you can get on savings accounts 2%. But out there at 5 years, they would only be loaning the interest rate on the loan would be 1.3%. Now they're actually charging more than 1.3% because they're banks and they can do that. But they are certainly not making this spread, the differential in value that they used to make. That makes banks more hesitant to make loans, which makes it more expensive, which makes it more difficult for businesses to invest, which means they'll make less stuff, which means they'll sell less stuff and there'll be less trading. And the end result is that somewhere down the road, the science of economics, if it is a science, says we'll start to see layoffs. And we've actually started to see them. They're just kind of invisible. We'll
right.
talk about that too.
At this point, I do believe economics is a science. We've been spending a lot of time observing and trying to make predictions off the observations. But we have enough data now that we can start to build the hypothesis.
It is an exact science.
Yeah, we're still in the hypothesis stage. We haven't ever gotten to theory.
Well, there's a couple of theories floating around.
Like what? Modern portfolio theory?
Yes.
It's technically called a theory on the paper in its form. It's still, if you look at the methodology of science, it's still a hypothesis.
Uh-huh.
It's just one that's been tested quite a bit so far. It's still not at the level
of
theory.
Hasn't been disproven. Which means it's the theory. Anyway, oil is the last element that we were going to talk about a little bit. And oil is in an interesting position right now where there's no crises. There's no big upset going on in the market someplace. So we can look at the price of oil and say that's another barometer. It dropped 5.8% this week, the price of West Texas Intermediate oil, to $52.94. Now, There's a lot of reasons for that, but the bottom line to it is very, very simple. We're seeing an accumulation of more oil in storage than there is demand, and the demand is steadily dropping with each quarter, with each month. It isn't reported as accurately as the stock market, but or as frequently, but we're seeing that the world demand for oil is slowing.
Right. We're seeing manufacturing dropping in the United States. All of these are normal. And when people hear us talking about this, they start saying, why are you so pessimistic? Well, can I throw this in there real quick? If it's December and the meteorologist is talking about temperatures dropping, you shouldn't say, why is the meteorologist so pessimistic? We could have summer again tomorrow. The market has weather. It's not as easy to predict as when summer occurs or when winter occurs, although to some extent it is, because the economy does tend to go slower in winter. Just hold that in your mind. If you look back through first quarter information, going back as far back as you want to see, you'll see on average that quarter is not as intense a growth as the rest of the year. And it's simply because it's cold and snowy and really kind of hard to get around in for a big chunk of the country for that part of the year, where the most profitable quarter quite often is the fourth quarter, because Christmas is right in the middle of it. That's seasonal. It's weather. If we recognize that the economy, we try really hard. Economists try really hard to make it look average and to seasonally adjust it. But the reality is that you really have to look at it seasonally, or it gets confusing. You have to look, what happens in winter? Well, fourth quarter, we tend to do better, not because the temperature's better or anything else, but because we've just had a good traditional harvest, Thanksgiving. We're bulking up in gift giving. We're being generous. Those are all good things for the economy. Generosity is great for the economy. And then the New Year's resolutions happen. Usually generosity is not one of the top things on the list for the New Year's resolution. It's something about cutting back your eating, doing more of things that cost less money, because you've just gone through a big generosity phase. And if you did that all year round, you might not have any money left. So all of this is part of this look at what is going on there, of the science. It's a behavior of large masses. And there's some things that we can predict. We can predict when Christmas is going to be. Is that amazing or what?
Well,
this year, it's going to fall the day after Christmas Eve.
That's a good sign.
Yeah. So what we can do is we can predict
what
happens around Christmas.
But there's some variance there.
Yeah, there is. There's variance to all of this.
No, there's variance because Salado has Christmas in October.
Oh, my goodness.
And they're going to have it this year.
I've got to go back to my economics model. So I'm going to rewrite the whole thing.
Could be an outlier, and probably is. Anyway, the big economic news for the week is the U.S. unemployment rate dropped to 3.5% in September, which is big. It's the lowest since 1969, and our participation rate is higher now than it was in 1969, which means we have a larger percentage of the population gainfully employed than we've ever had in history, which sounds really impressive. It sounds impressive to me.
Yeah. As a percentage of our population, as a raw number, any way you want to measure it, we're at the highest level of employment that the United States has ever experienced.
And really, 1969, we were cheating because we had the draft, and we had lots and lots and lots of people being drafted into the Army and going to
Vietnam. They didn't have a little thing in there that said, is this voluntary employment or involuntary?
No.
That's not part of the statistics.
So we had virtually zero unemployment in effect in 1969.
And we're there again.
And we're back there again. 3.5% is amazingly low. It represents, by most standards, full employment, although some economists say there's still some slack in there somewhere, obviously.
Otherwise, we wouldn't still be able to hire people every month.
And
that if we look at the unemployment rate, that 3.5%, what we're losing in 1 month and gaining back in the next month, it's still a net positive. We're growing as far as employment goes.
And the other figure that comes out at the same time is the number of new jobs that were created and filled in the United States. Now, when you say new jobs created, that's not an opening and we're trying to hire somebody. That's actually somebody got hired.
Somebody left the job versus, and we're refilling it. No, that's not the – this is a new position.
Yeah, versus the number of people that were laid off or quit or whatever. So we created 136,000 jobs in September, which sounds very, very impressive until you realize that all of last year and going into the beginning of this year, if we'd hit 200,000, people would be very disappointed and say we're way down. 250,000 was much closer to the norm a year ago.
Yeah.
Which indicates that the number of new jobs we're creating is slowly sliding downhill, which matches the other information we've gotten from some other places.
Yeah. That I agree with that.
But there's an interesting point in the midst of this, and you dig down into the jobs report, it really looks impressive. The new jobs, the positives, were all in the services side.
Yeah. Manufacturing had a drop.
Yeah, we actually saw manufacturers laying off more people than they were hiring. Now, manufacturing isn't a big chunk of our economy anymore. Services is a much bigger chunk of the economy. But here's the key. Manufacturing, historically, there's no guarantee this will happen, obviously, in the present or into the future. But historically, manufacturing is kind of like the canary in the coal mine.
Right.
When manufacturing starts contracting, it's just a matter of time in most cases. Now, there have been a couple of cases where manufacturing contracted and we didn't actually get a recession. But in most cases, when manufacturing goes into contraction, it's not very long before the rest of the economy follows.
I'm going to give an anecdote. This is a couple of conversations that I had this week. So it's not by any stretch a sign of what's happening everywhere, but it's a good symbol that it might be. I spoke with multiple CPAs this week for clients, talking about some relatively complicated tax situations to figure out what's going on. And that's kind of irrelevant what I was talking about. It's October. And if you're in the tax business, you understand that there's two rush seasons. There's the April time frame and the October time frame. If somebody's done an extension, it's usually going to be a more complicated return. And both CPAs that I spoke with this week were frantic. They said that they have never seen, and this is completely different firms, separated by about 100 miles. They've never seen this many complex tax returns being set up in October, that they are just buried in it. And a lot of the returns that they're doing are returns for people that have been doing their own taxes for a long time. So they've got a really big dig deep to figure out what's been happening in the past and how to carry all that stuff forward and figure out if the decisions were made correctly in the past. Why am I saying this? Because we just said the service industry is adding jobs. And both CPAs that I spoke to said that they were considering adding new positions, that they can't just go out and find new CPAs. They are all pretty much employed, but they're adding to their staff because this is much more complicated than it used to be. And I know to the majority of people, taxes got simpler in 2017. If you own a business or you're a partial owner of a business, your taxes got a lot more complicated in 2017, particularly if you're above a certain income level. And so what that does is it causes more demand for other people to do that work. And that's a kind of an interesting thought on how efficient a tax system is. If the payment to file the taxes amounts to a significant portion of the tax revenue, then simplifying the tax code would gain back all that extra money. It would cost some CPAs their jobs, though.
It would cost a lot of congressmen their jobs.
Yes. So,
by the way, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. The telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. Presuming that is that today is October 5th where you are of 2019. And if it's not October 5th, then this is probably a replay. And if it's before October 5th, 2019, then you're prescient.
How did you do that?
That was cool.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's possible, but I don't know how it's done. Anyway, part of that jobs report was that hourly earnings have risen 2.9%. What was that, a cricket or? Oh, it was a cricket on my shoulder. And he came and got the cricket off my shoulder. Talking about a cricket picket. Anyway, hourly earnings have risen 2.9% from 1 year ago, and the Bureau of Economic Analysis reported the disposable personal income from July to August. Now, there's a month differential here. Rose 0.5%, and expenditures rose 0.1%. And that it says what we mentioned last week, that even though disposable income was up 0.5%, 80% of that roughly is being used for paying off debts by consumers. And that's an indication that we're probably going to see sometime in the next couple of months the consumer spending start to slow. Well, it actually has started to slow down because it's only rising now at 0.1% per month, which is a little less than it actually. So it's about 1% a year, whereas previously it was rising 6% a year. So we won't see the impact of that for a month or two after the fact. The bottom line to this is that the one thing that is keeping the economy in the positive position, because, well, let me back up. I didn't give you the other thing, is the manufacturing ISM report. Now, ISM says it's the Institute for Supply Management.
And there's usually a little circled R. It's a registered trademark.
Right. And then they have a purchasing manager's index. Now, what's a purchasing manager's index? That is the people in major corporations, both manufacturing and in the service corporations, who buy the stuff that is necessary to make the business run. And in the manufacturing area, that's the raw materials and parts that are needed to assemble something in manufacturing. Over on the services side, there is also a purchasing manager's index. And you say, what do they need in the services side? Well, services include things like restaurants, and yeah,
they've got to order
CPAs,
equipment and food and all kinds of things.
And erasers and paper and pencils.
Right. Napkins.
And so, as I said earlier, the manufacturing side of the economy historically has been the lead indicator of where the economy is going.
Yeah. If you look at the traditional buying amount at a service side versus at a manufacturer side, you'll see there's a lot more raw material purchases on the manufacturing side.
But the purchasing manager index leads the manufacturing index because that's, you got to have the stuff before you can do anything. And the business managers are looking at this and saying, we need more pencils, or we need more food, or we need more whatever.
Concrete bagging machines or anything.
Well, the thing that was there were two shockers this week. One was a little bit positive and the other one was surprising on the negative side.
Right. So you're using a very mixed metaphor here. You said shocker and you said positive and negative.
Yep.
People may think we're talking electricity here.
It could be.
Okay. There's a shocker with a positive and a negative. Go ahead.
The Institute for Supply Management's September Purchasing Managers Index. That was a mouthful, but now you understand it.
This is why we are comparing it to electricity. It's sometimes unpleasant to touch.
It dropped to 47.8. Now, 50 means it's neither expanding nor contracting. Anything above 50, it's expanding and we're accelerating. Anything below 50, we're slowing down. We're contracting. And last month was 49.1, and the month before that was 54, I think it was. And a year ago, it was 60. We're going great guns. But it's been up and down and up and down and up and down in the numbers. But the point is, it has been, if you run the averages, it is steadily decelerating ever since the imposition of guess what?
The trade war.
The tariffs.
Yeah.
And the higher the tariffs go, the lower the number gets. And
this isn't rocket surgery. This is
rocket surgery.
Yes, it's not rocket surgery, folks. Right. All you have to do is recognize that when things get more expensive, people buy them not as much usually.
That's true.
That's kind of a statement of fact. And if you lay that across an entire economy, if you put tariffs on things, people buy less of things.
So what we're seeing is we're seeing a contraction already in place. This is 2 months now that we've seen a contraction in manufacturing purchaser manager index. At the same time, we're starting to see the orders slow down. We're seeing the, which makes sense. We're seeing the deliveries slow down. We're seeing, and I say slow down, there's fewer of them. The speed of the deliveries, interestingly enough, has gone up, which makes sense because there's fewer of them and they can get to you quicker.
Right.
But
and we can see it in, for instance, when we're looking at capacity utilization. That's a number that a lot of people are like, "What? What are you talking about? Capacity utilization? What does that even mean?" It means how much throughput can you put through one factory? How many cars can you put through one road at a time without having a traffic jam that just stops everything? And if you get above about 80%, you start getting really big traffic jams. It slows down the average movement. And that's not just on roads. It's on factories and everywhere else. That 80% mark is kind of a magical number, because that 20% above it, it's just not enough wiggle room to, if one slowdown happens, everything gets slowed down. And that's where we've been for a while. We're dropping there. We've got more truck drivers available. We've got more factory space available. You throw that all together, it's just another sign of a slowdown. It's not a cliff. It's not, we're not in free fall. It's a slowdown in growth. And in some cases, it's an actual step back from where we were a year ago.
Do we have any commercials to do?
We do.
We probably ought to do commercials.
Would you like to play some?
Well, not particularly, but we'll do it anyway.
All right, we'll do it. We'll be back on the other side of with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yeah, what do you say? And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. I think we did that well.
I don't know.
What I said.
We think.
Telephone number in here, 254-773-1400. Presuming it is October 5th, Saturday, 2019, wherever you are. You know, we talked about the fact that the Institute for Supply Management Purchasing Managers Index dropped to 47.8, which indicates it's contracting. There's some backup information for that. The manufacturing trends are following that PMI downward. Transportation orders, meaning orders for new cars, trucks, et cetera, down 8.4% from a year ago. And it's orders, not production. The strike at General Motors, for example, will slow production down, but it doesn't slow the orders down. Core capital good orders down 0.4%. So factory orders fell 0.1% in August after rising in July. See, in July, there was an interesting little bump that caused a lot of commentators, and you probably don't read all the commentators that I do, saying maybe we're not headed towards recession. Maybe we're at the bottom, and now we got a recovery because we had a little bump in manufacturing with orders up 1.4%. The other side of that is people were saying, no, that jump in orders was to try to get some stuff bought before the tariffs hit. The other thing that happened, though, that was, and then there's other things we can talk about, trade deficit and so on that rose, but on the non-manufacturing side of our economy, and that is the only thing that's really holding us from falling in the ditch, it's being supported a little bit by government spending, which is up. So is the deficit, as you probably know. But what's keeping us from sliding into recession is consumer spending.
Yeah, government spending has been kind of slowed.
And that is almost all over on the services side. People going out to eat, people going to the movies, people using CPAs like Jake was talking about a little earlier. People, I don't think it's people filing for bankruptcy. That's probably at a low.
It's probably a little less of that.
But Ed's business is probably doing pretty
good.
Yeah,
it's doing well.
So that's what's keeping us going. And here's the problem. That also was 60 a year ago on a scale where 50 is the dividing line between expansion and contraction. And it has been sliding downhill, and it's now at 52.6. Now, 52.6 is still expansion. It's still growing, which means that the hiring is still going on and should be going on at a lower rate, and that's what we're seeing. But if this keeps up, if the trend that we've seen over the last year continues, sometime in the next 2 to 3 months, you will see the services purchasing managers index dropped below 50. Now, there's no guarantees on that, but we got a really strong trend and no real reason not to see that happen. And when once all of them drop below 50, then the clock, the time clock starts. The somebody flips the hourglass over and said we're going to get a recession within a relatively short period of time.
And I'm just looking here. I'm going to pull up a longer term, a 10-year graph of bankruptcies. Obviously, we have a huge peak at the end of 2009 and up through 2010. And then we have a very, very smooth, it's almost like a ski slope, decline in bankruptcies through 2017 and into the July of 2018. And then since then, we've started back up. So not up significantly, but enough that it's noticeable on a 10-year graph that we're starting to head in a different direction than we have for 10 years.
Well, there's an interesting little anecdote here. There was an all-time record hit last month, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was pretty high, for the number of mall stores closing. Now, that sounds a little strange. The number of and across the board, now this is about 2 months old, we're at or near a record number of bricks and mortar storefronts closing across the United States. And you can drive, for instance, here in Temple, you can and drive into some of the strip centers, shopping centers in the area and look around and you see that no longer are they at 100% occupancy. You're
right.
Seeing more and more
right.
Where there's an empty
room for rent. Yeah.
You basically have a vacancy and or a going out of business sale or something.
And we've got some downward pressure on rent on the rental market and on the ownership market in real estate, and that we've been building for a while.
And what we're seeing
getting an extra inventory
is a lot of businesses that are borrowed money and recently, by the way, have reborrowed to cover their borrowing costs and are on the edge. And when we get a downturn, and we will get a downturn at some point, this is what cleans out the deadwood. There's a lot of companies that are zombie companies out there right now that are operating on borrowed money. For example, and I, you know, as an example, any of you have ever used Uber, Uber has never made money. They're losing money.
Well, they made one quarter.
But they well okay.
One quarter they made a profit. But what do you call that? Is it a profit if one quarter you're in the black for the whole year you're not?
Yeah.
Not for taxes, it's not.
So the idea is that there's a lot of innovative companies out there that we look at and say this is an important thing, this is a new thing that's going on out there that are operating on borrowed money and dependent upon very, very low interest rates. Once we see a recession get started and people start to slow down their spending, I strongly suspect we're going to see a cascade, and that's what happens in a recession, a cascade of these businesses going out of business and laying people off. And when that happens, that's the feedback that causes a recession, is something triggers it, but the something that triggers it isn't the underlying cause. The underlying cause is building businesses gradually build up and become a lot of nonprofit businesses that never were meant to be nonprofit. Continue to be in business just like they did. If any of you that are old enough and have good enough memories to remember the 1990s when there were lots and lots of IPOs and businesses that never had made a profit and really didn't have any idea how to make a profit, we've got those out there.
Right.
And one by one, you're starting to see them go down. Now, they're going down faster in Europe and in Great Britain, which we follow to some degree.
If we want to talk about interest rates, there are still some places in the world with high interest rates.
Not in Europe.
Argentina's interest rate's right around 77%.
Wow.
Yeah. That's not a recommendation for Argentina, by the way, guys. That means inflation is in hyper mode.
Yeah,
right there. Zimbabwe's at 70%, and that sounds safe, right?
Sure. Actually,
Venezuela's only at 27.87.
All depends if you
or 28.82.
If you've got dollars and you're in Zimbabwe, you're rich by definition because the value of the dollar that you have in your pocket goes up every day.
Right.
But there's a real shortage of dollars there for some reason, mainly because the government will take them away from you.
Yeah.
Anyway, the total economy across the board is being held up by the services sector. And services dropped to 52.6. Consumer spending is slowing down. Instead of growing at 6% a year, it's growing at basically 1% a year at this point. These are all indicators. Now, do they guarantee that we'll have a recession? No. but it sure looks like we're forecasting something is slowing. A lot of things are slowing down. And what's the cause? Well, one, it's just the time for that to happen. This, once you hit maximum capacity utilization, which we did early this year, late last year, from there, historically, we've seen things start to fall apart. Why? Because there's just a lot of zombie businesses. The more zombie businesses go into effect, the more zombie-like the right. economy gets.
Recessions are necessary. This is something that when people – I've heard this from multiple people lately. They're talking about how pessimistic we are about the future. And I say, how do you get that? I think I'm tremendously optimistic. And they say, well, you keep talking about a recession. And this is that thing I come back to again and again. Recessions are weather. You cannot expect to go on a vacation every time without having adverse weather conditions. You just prepare for them. And knowing that the weather is coming is how you prepare for them. It's not like any recession in the United States is going to crush our economy forever. That would take something huge, far beyond even like the depression of the 1920s, 30s, into the 40s. We're talking about full-on invasion. And if we look around the world at established countries and them falling apart socioeconomically, has it ever happened? Well, yeah, the Roman Empire fell. France was at top of the heap, and it's not at the top of the heap anymore. Spain was top of the heap. The UK was top of the heap. The Netherlands was top of the heap. You go through all the different places that have been top of the heap. Has there ever been a socioeconomic collapse that they haven't recovered from? And in some cases, yes. I mean, Sparta and Athens disappeared. But when you get into larger countries, including places like the Soviet Union, did they have a socioeconomic collapse? Yes. How long did it last? Decades. But Russia is it's not in great shape economically right now, but it went through a period of pretty good growth between the collapse and now. And they're kind of volunteering for the financial heartache that they're in right now, in that they're invading other countries and other countries are now putting sanctions on them, where the United States is kind of volunteering for higher prices by putting a trade war out there. Now, let me throw this out there before people think that I'm just politically anti anybody. The president hasn't been really clear about the purpose of the trade war. So we can hypothesize. There have been some references to free trade at the end of it by the administration. If the trade war is a negotiating tactic to get us a really good trade deal, then the rules of measuring the damage to the economy right now, we're not talking about permanent damage. We're talking about something that hopefully is imminently recoverable. If this is the new norm, then we're creating permanent damage. We're creating structures that are destroying an existing business model, lots of existing business models, and where their supplies come from and so on. So from an economics perspective, we have to look at both sides of that. If this is a negotiation ploy, this is a method of getting someone else to agree broadly with us on how to move forward with trade, there may be great benefits in the future. Here's the thing. When people talk about the trade war, they talk about China. Our tariffs are on the majority, the vast majority of the planet, not just China. We just happen to buy a lot of stuff from China. This trade war is a much larger thing, and if it means that we go into free trade across the board with everybody, with agreements on what that means, it might be a permanent benefit. But there has been zero push in that direction from the administration.
Let me throw one more thing out here.
Go ahead.
And what we're going to talk about hopefully next hour is what you can do about this more practically. But, you know, we've been raising the tariffs.
Yeah.
And the tariffs are up. They're supposed to jump again in December 15th.
Yeah.
But the majority of the increase in tariffs has already occurred. And our trade balance continues to get worse.
Yeah. Record trade imbalance right now.
And the reason is, as long as we're prosperous in the United States, and we did see a 2.9% rise in wages in the United States over the last year, and people have more money to spend, and they are still continuing to increase their spending, which keeps the economy going, our trade deficit's going to get worse.
Yeah, because we don't have the capacity to build all the things right now that we want to buy right now.
And there's tariffs on our exports. And as a result of all of that, the trade deficit actually got worse by about $74 billion last month. And it continues to worsen. It continues to run downhill. And the issue is very, very simple. The tariffs are not reducing the deficit.
And we are about out of time for this hour. If you would like to contact us off the air, we have our firm does fiduciary independent investment advice to people of high net worth. We have voicemail waiting during the weekends and real live people during the week locally at
254-947-1111.
Or toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our website, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and read our newsletters, listen to recordings of the radio program going back quite a few years, read our philosophy, and you can send us emails. You can contact us through the website or directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal.